Hello there, I'm Jyotika. So I had the great pleasure recently of interviewing Prakasha about Gokiloka. Prakasha has had a long association with the valley. He lived in the Vihara for several years and has done a number of long solitary retreats there too. I began by asking him when he first visited the place.
It would have been quite soon after they bought it, really. So I started doing a series of solitary retreats in the early 90s. I'd had a connection with Old Blocky and been out there three times. And then going on solitary retreat at Gokiloka just seemed to follow on from doing these various retreats at Old Blocky, which was nearby.
So did you know... the guy who found
Dolph.
Yeah, he exactly. Knew Dolph.
Yes, and also Vajrayogini.
Oh, yeah.
So I was doing retreats at Old Blocky with both of them. So I was familiar with the history of Gokiloka. So during the 90s, I was living at Pabloka as a member of the ordination team. So I joined Pabloka in 91. And then in 92, I went to Gokiloka for the three-month ordination retreat. So that was my first long retreat at Gokiloka. So Subhuti and Sona were leading that, and I had a great time with it.
Yeah.
So that went really well. There was at least 30 people ordained. I was with some very close friends. And I was part of the team, and I really loved that. Yeah, so I still got photos of it. and then I had 5 years on the ordination team at Pabloka, and I'd done these different study seminars at least six times, so six of them six times, and I thought, well, I just wanted to go and live at Gokiloka. So there was a number of people who were interested in having this thing, but we started calling the Vihara. So that was, I went up there in 96 with Arthur Darshan. So we left Pabloka and I started with a big adventure with Arthur Darshan. So we went out to Ladakh. It was a big adventure. We were walking across Ladakh of a way with ponies right across the plateau to Leh, and then we went to Nepal. I did the Everest circuit, so it was just a big adventure, really. What were several big adventures?
Why the big adventures before?
The whole thing was very adventurous, really. Just leaving Pabloka and embarking on an entirely new lifestyle.
And why did you want to do that?
To go deeper with my own meditation practice and to live a small sort of hermitage lifestyle, really. So we were offered a Banti's bungalow. That was all that was there. And it was up to us to create the rest of the facilities. So we didn't have to work. We had no responsibilities. So there was Sagravantara, Padmakara, who was there, myself, Arthur Darshan. So that's how it started off. And different community members came and went, but Sagravantara and I were the two main members who were there for the entire time. And Arthur Darshan built himself a hut. Sagravantara had a yurt up on the hillside. I was living in the bungalow and eventually got myself a yurt and built a yurt platform. So we just lived a very simple life like that for 5 years.
And what was like an average day?
An average day was we'd all get on with our own practice in the morning, so we wouldn't actually meet up. So I'd be meditating, doing yoga in my own yurt. We'd all do that in our own space. So we'd have quite a strong practice mornings where we'd be meditating, studying. And then we'd come together, I think, for lunch at around 2 o'clock. So we'd always have lunch in the afternoon. We'd always meet up. Then the afternoon, there might be some work. We might go for a walk. There'd be more meditation. We had an exercise period, and then dinner. Dinner was actually brought to us by the retreat centre. So we didn't need to cook dinner. So for 5 years, I was receiving cooked dinners. But we had, did we have cooking facilities? Yes, we did, but they were quite basic. And then in the evening, meditation puja, and just carried on like that for 5 years, really.
Did you leave the valley much?
I did. Not all that much, though. Maybe once or twice a year. So there were no deadlines. There was nothing, in a way, going to happen. Every day was, you could say, exactly the same. But it felt like entering into a timelessness, really. So there was only the present moment. And we entered into that as fully as possibly as we could.
And were people practicing celibacy? Was there
So we were celibate for the period. Mm. I'm just living a kind of a simple lifestyle, really. Mm. When I left Pamaloka and arrived, I was quite frightened because it was sort of going into the deep end. It was the unknown. And none of us knew what we were entering into or how it would work out. And this very strong camaraderie built up between those staying there. Arthur Darshan was a very close friend. Sagarbhaja became a very close friend. Dhirumati came to stay for a year. Padmakara was there the first year. There was a close sense of kinship and brotherhood. So it was one of the, I mean, I like to think about it as probably the most important thing I've done in my life, really. For me, the 5 years were an absolutely wonderful experience of, dedicating myself to spiritual practice, the most intense spiritual practice I've ever engaged in, really. And by the end of it, I mean, I really established my own meditation practice. The insight I mentioned had really begun to develop, what was underway. When I left in 2001, then I was really set up to become a meditation and Dharma teaching. So for the next 25 years, I was leading retreats and introducing people to, many order members to meditation and Dharma. But it all kind of grew out of that 5 year period where it just really established my meditation practice. I went very, very deep. I worked through a lot of things, did all sorts of sadhanas, wrote lots of pujas, just really engaged very deeply. Had a lot of time to study, a lot of time to meditate. I'd like to think of it as still, after 25 years, it's one of the best times in my life, really, about which I have no regrets. I have had regrets about leaving, but there we go. You know, I didn't have any regrets about being there. But events moved on anyway, and eventually left.
So did you know what you were doing when you were there, in the sense of we didn't have a tradition at that stage, not that we have much of it now, of going on long retreats, people doing long retreats, living in Vihara-like conditions?
Yeah. No, we really had no idea at all. So we were making it up as we went along, really. And we didn't want to live a very routinized, scheduled kind of life. We wanted to keep things quite spontaneously. We wanted to live in the forest tradition. So we weren't all doing the same thing at the same time in a more monastic kind of way. So we each wanted a lot of time to develop our own practice in our own kind of way, really. So it wasn't a highly programmed or routinized kind of life. So we were quite inspired by this book, Buddhist Saints in India, which had just come out at that time by Reginald Ray. So that describes the difference between the forest life and the monastic life. So we thought of ourselves as being forest renunciates. Well, we were actually living in a forest. There were woods there. We were living very simply, basically. So my yurt had had some solar power lighting, but very minimally. It had no heating. When it was hot, I got hot, and when it was cold, I got cold, really. It was just living in a very kind of basic kind of way.
But no wood-burning stove?
No wood-burning stove, no. So at times it did go right down to freezing. So, yeah, it was pretty challenging, it has to be said. But I was up for it. We were all up for it. I was in my 40s. And, yeah, very much up for it, really. So there wasn't a lot of comfort excess, really. Facilities were basic.
So when you didn't know what you were doing, you were making it up as you went along, but I imagine at some stage a clearing emerged or a path emerged, yeah, or you, yeah, got a sense. What was that, yeah, like, or what, yeah, shape did that take?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, I think that emerged fairly soon, really. So the day I've described really started quite early on, and the lifestyle I described really started quite early on, and we just carried on with that. For the entire period. So we did have definite ideas, I suppose, about what we wanted before we went there. But yes, it was also very experimental. We knew what we didn't want. And we knew we wanted to live quite freely. And particularly emphasize on timelessness, fully being present in the moment and being present each day, and each day being completely new and unprogrammed, without definite deadlines, really. So there were no deadlines. So in a way, we wanted to abolish time as much as possible.
Okay. And was there disharmony at all between people? And what about challenges, personal challenges?
There was a challenge of each one of us working on our own personal process. Stuff would come up and we'd have to work with that. But I definitely had the idea of going deeper. So the metaphor was depth and going deeper and turning towards whatever was there and working with whatever came up. So we had a very sort of a clear understanding about that. I don't remember any kind of interpersonal conflict, so to speak. I think there was just personality tensions and so on, you know, just the everyday tensions of living with people. But overall, it was very harmonious. So certainly during the 5 years I was living there, when I left, the situation carried on and it didn't fare so well. So there were a different group of people. So the horror carried on for a few years. But then, when I left, things changed quite drastically. But for the period I was there and with the people that I was with, it was very good. So we'd have, we'd have some meetings to organise ourselves, community meetings. Every supper time, we'd do this thing that the Three Musketeers did. You know, well, we'd hold hands and say all for one and one for all, and we did that every day, every evening for 5 years. You know, so it must have meant something for us. So there was this sense of brotherhood and camaraderie. So I would say a very strong sense of camaraderie. But there was criticism. Not everybody thought that the way we were going about things was the right way. So some people thought that we should be living a much more routinized community sort of lifestyle where we were all doing the same thing. But we didn't want that. We were quite clear about that. But some people thought what we were doing was individualistic. But I don't think it was. I think they were really missing just how radical an approach we were taking, which really worked. Well, it really worked for me anyway. I can't say it worked for everybody. It did demand that you were very self-motivated. So those people who weren't as self-motivated as I was perhaps didn't fare as well. But yeah, for the self-motivated, it was extremely beneficial.
Did Bante have input?
No, not really. He did come and stay at the Vihara whilst we were there for different periods. It was his bungalow. We were living in his bungalow and around his bungalow. But no, he didn't. I don't actually remember him having any particular input. I think he was just very happy to let us get on with it, on with what we were doing.
You've spoken at times about shadow work. You gave a talk there a few months ago, Making the Great Descent.
Yeah.
Was that something you had to tackle when you were there, or was that mostly processed before you arrived?
No, that was certainly something that we were working on. In fact, that whole idea of making the Great Descent really came out of my time at Gyuloka. So that was exploration, really. I'd had an ascent-orientated lifestyle before that into Dhyana. So the question was, well, what happened if we engaged in this deeper turning towards and made the Great Descent? So that was very, very enriching. So we had a strong emphasis on the imagination, on symbolism, on myth, on archetype, living out our personal myth. Yeah, so that was very important.
When the inside aspects started to emerge, What was that like?
I think it was progressive in a way, really. So obviously I was working with insight practice all the way through. But the very last month I was at Gyuloka, I finished my 5 years with a solitary retreat. And then during that retreat, I had a very significant vision of Sarvabuddha Dakini, of Vajrayogini. And that vision lasted for some time. And I think it was a Sambhogakaya Kaya vision. So it was very significant and important for me. And later on, when I went back, that vision just continued, really, for me. And eventually I introduced the two Vajrayogini sadhanas into the order as a result of that. The dancing form and the standing form of Vajrayogini. That was a very significant experience, and I understood Vajrayogini as being the Dakini manifestation of Prajnaparamita. So it was really an understanding of the perfection of wisdom, and of seeing clearly about the nature of how things are, and a recognition of the essential nature of pure awareness. So that's what happened during the time. So it wasn't just simply, but it was a vision. It was a direct recognition of the nature of mind and of pure awareness. So that was very, very significant. And after I got back, that continued to deepen, particularly around the year 2003, 2005. And I had further very significant experiences. But that 5 years was really the basis for that. And that visionary experience was very deeply transformative. It was a very profound experience.
Did it arise spontaneously?
Yes. So it did. Can't say where it came from. It just happened. That's what happened. I've still got the notebook describing it. I can't say more about that, really.
In the sense you can't say more because you don't understand the process of its arising?
Well, I can only just say that it happened. So it was a fruitional experience. I can only imagine that it was, it felt like the fruition of my entire 5 years kind of coming together in one single experience and manifesting very fully and directly.
And when you say it was around, so was it there outside of meditation?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. Mm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And exactly a week after I received this vision, so my solitary retreat had ended, I started receiving these teachings from Pragyaparamita. So over the course of 7 days, I received seven different teachings, which I just wrote down from Pragyaparamita. So it was 30 pages of teaching. And at the end, there was this poetry reading organized for the community members. And they asked me, well, would you like to do a reading? So I said, yes, I would like to. And as it happens, I do have something. So, of course, I read the teachings that I received from Pragyaparamita. And, of course, there's a general sense of astonishment because they were really quite remarkable. So it was a very uplifting evening. I must have gone on for quite a long time. I can't remember how long it took me to read the 30 pages, but it was a very significant evening. And that evening was a kind of culmination of process, really, not long after that I left.
Have you thought of publishing them?
No, they're just quite personal, really.
Okay.
Although the content is, well, it is just the perfection of wisdom, you know. But no, I wouldn't want to publish it.
What about in the puja reading? Have you read it since?
I prefer to keep it just to myself, really, because it's kind of indescribable. And, yeah, it keeps the uniqueness of that particular experience intact, really.
Was there anything like that from Vajrayogini, a communication in that?
Well, Vajrayogini, as I understood it, is Pragyaparamita in her ruffled tantric form. So a teaching was coming from Pragyaparamita, and Vajrayogini was just manifesting the tantric form of Pragyaparamita manifesting. So Pragyaparamita is, and still is, one of my main sadhana practices.
Great. So then why did you feel it was time to move on?
Well, I fell in love. So I met someone and I left to I was no longer in a position to keep a brahmacharya that was a requirement to live in the bar.
That's interesting. So I guess we usually fall in love because, well, for lots of reasons, but it sounds like the way you describe your life in the Vihara was very rich, very fulfilling.
Yeah.
You were very connected, strong sense of brotherhood.
Yeah.
You were having experiences of ascent and descent,
yeah.
And then towards the end receiving teachings.
Mm.
But obviously there was a part of you that was not being touched or met by the conditions in the Vihara. Would that be correct?
Well, perhaps. I mean, one could see it like that. Or one could just see, well, this was just the next thing that I needed to do. So the jury's out on that, really. I wouldn't like to say exactly. The next phase of my life was very much teaching and leading retreats. That's pretty much what I've been doing for the last 25 years, leading a whole series of retreats, mainly for order members on meditation. So I moved to Vajracuta in North Wales. So by 2003, I moved in there. I'd started that as a kind of small retreat centre for order retreats, and I was leading my own style of retreats, and they really grew out of the time I'd spent at Guluk.
Had you been in love before?
Oh, yes.
It wasn't your first?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No.
It has, I've met order members who fell in love for the first time in their 40s.
Yeah, no, that wasn't me.
And can you say a little bit about Arthur Darshan then?
Yes, so Arthur Darshan and I were very close friends. He was there for the very first year. But after that, he had a teenage daughter. She was put in prison for drugs. So he was called back to England to visit his daughter in prison. So he was back living in England, visiting her. So that carried on for a while. But then he came back to Vihara, moved back, built himself a cabin, and was there the last year of his life. And then, when was it? I think it was October, October, November 1999. We were doing these three-month retreats. So Savravajra, myself, Arthur Darshan, were coming to the end of these three-month retreats. And one morning, he just went out for a run and was running up the path. A man just collapsed and died, really, of some kind of heart seizure. So that was very, very dramatic for all of us.
He was in his 40s.
He was in his 40s, yeah. He was about 44, very fit. A helicopter came, but by the time it came, he was dead. So everyone from the retreat center was standing around, and the helicopter came, and eventually we went into Alicante Hospital, that he was pronounced dead. So that was a very powerful time for me, and he and I had entered into a friendship ritual, and I'd already agreed to undertake the 49-day Bardo ritual for him. So I'd been on solitary retreat for about 12 weeks, so I carried on for another 7 weeks. So I was reciting the Tibetan Book of the Dead every day, engaging in a variety of rituals. Every day I go to the place very near the retreat center where he collapsed and died, and I just sit there by the road, and I was full of grief. I was in tears. You know, it really was a very powerful experience for me to have been there when he died, and to be undertaking the 49-day Bardo ritual. So I carry on with that. Work with my own grief. Did a lot of meditation. And finished the 49 days. And the very end of the 49 days, had a dream, as one does, had a dream. And in the dream, Arthur Darshan was there completely, you know, I really thought he was Arthur Darshan. It was as if he was visiting me. I was pleased to see him. I said hello in the dream. There he was. And of course, when I did that, I woke up. You know, so suddenly, suddenly, of course, he was gone. But that happened the morning after the 49-day Bardo ritual. during that time, he'd had his funeral in England, so I didn't actually attend that. So that was the end of 1999. Yeah. So that's Arthur Darshan.
That must have been quite something to be in solitary for so long with your own grief.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
And so that was towards the end of your 5 years, was it?
Yeah, so that was the end of 1999 and I left in August 2001, yeah.
So do you think that precipitated a moving out of the Vihara?
I don't think so, no. No, I don't think so. Mm. So, well, those who were left, we just carried on. But certainly it was a big, yeah, it was a big happening. But by 2001, Sagaravantra had been diagnosed with a particular illness, a debilitating illness. So he was having difficulties. Arthur Darshan was dead. Dhiramati had left. So, yeah, it was, in a way, it was just time to leave, really. Mm.
Mm. Mm. Okay. So then, let's fast forward. You didn't spend a lot of time between then and 2018, 2019 in the valley?
Well, I came back, I did several solitary retreats. So I came back several times for solitary retreats for a month or so. And then I started getting asked to teach on the, I think there were 3 month retreats in the autumn. So I'd come for a month. So that happened several times. Bodhidharma was inviting me to that. And then I also came a couple of times to Uttaraloka at Bodhidharma's request to be on the 1 year retreats there. So I came for a couple of weeks twice and say hello to the community members and give various teachings. Yeah. But the last time, of course, I was there was the mushroom incident.
Well, you'll have to share the mushroom incident to tell us about it.
Yeah, so that was now 6 years ago in the autumn, and I was staying in one of the huts, and whilst I was living in the huts, I remember this autumn where we ate all these mushrooms, and the mushrooms were... Yeah, we really enjoyed these mushrooms. So I thought, oh, well, it was just an edible mushroom. Anyway, it turned out it wasn't an edible mushroom. It was deadly poisonous.
So sorry, when you were in the Vihara, you ate these mushrooms? Mm-hmm. And did somebody know about mushrooms? Did they?
No.
So you all took a risk in eating a foraged mushroom and you had a good time and it was all very tasty and pleasant.
Yeah.
And then fast forward to 2019, you find a mushroom that you think is the same mushroom.
Yeah.
And you think, well, I had a lovely time with that. I'm going to eat it again.
That's correct, I suppose. Yeah. But when I ate the mushroom, I had it fried up for breakfast. And then after that, I couldn't eat. I couldn't drink. I vomited up everything.
Was this within a few hours?
So within the first day. So I spent about 4 days not being able to eat, drink or sleep. And then things weren't getting any better. By that time I was delirious. And then I arranged to get a flight out. So Mani Raja got me a flight out. I flew back to England.
So you knew it was serious enough you couldn't go to the hospital in Alicante?
It seemed best to actually get myself out. So I went to the Shrewsbury Hospital, went to A&E, and saw the doctor, and they said my kidneys had almost stopped working. I was suffering from kidney failure, so I might die. So I found myself in hospital ward. I'd been on solitary retreat for 2 weeks, and I was in a really, really positive state. So I really had no idea about dying or kidney transplants or anything like that. I was just in a super positive state. So even though my body was seriously affected by this mushroom and so on, I was really happy and in a very positive state. And the very first day in the ward, I started having a vision of Padmasambhava. So Padmasambhava appeared in front of me, and from the vase of immortality that he holds, there were two streams of nectar, red and white nectar, coming to both of my kidneys and purifying my kidneys. And this carried on for about 2 hours. And I could see Padmasambhava right there in front of me in the middle of a ward. I was on a drip at the time. And Padmasambhava was in the context of his mandala. So below Padmasambhava was the Buddha. To one side of Padmasambhava was Machip Lakdron, a Dakini figure. But to the other side of Padmasambhava was Milarepa. And above Padmasambhava was Prajnaparamita. So it was a mandala of six figures. So Padmasambhava was the primary form. And there was this nectar pouring down from the vase of immortality to my kidneys. And I knew everything was going to be all right. I was able to recognize Padmasambhava. So he appeared as a mass of light and asked me to repeat the long life Padmasambhava mantra, which I did for the entire 2 hours and subsequently.
You weren't interrupted by doctors or nurses or?
Not that I remember. No, I think it all just carried on really. And then Sri Sangha, my partner, came, and Karina Chitta, my sister, came. And I told them, by this time I was sitting up in bed and I was smiling, I was happy, that they could see something very substantial had changed. And I told them I'd had a really amazing experience that they needed to write down. So they took dictation and I communicated the entire experience to them. I'm rather prone to having experiences like that, so they weren't at all surprised. And after about 4 days, I was released from hospital. The doctor couldn't really believe it, you know, because I was at death's door, and then quite suddenly I was on the way out. I was exhausted for 2 months after that. But after that, I was fine, and I had no further problems. So it was a very powerful transformative experience, and it's given me the confidence of being able to, when I die, to be able to recognize deities appearing in the Bardo. So it was an experience of a clear light, and I was able to recognize the deities, Sasambhava Gaya deities, and to directly receive the blessings. So that was all to the good and has given me confidence that I'll be able to do that when the time comes for me to die.
When the doctors, before you had the vision of Padmasambhava, when the doctors had been assessing you, did they have a sense of the treatment you needed? Was it a kidney replacement? Was it that serious?
They were just giving me a kidney flush. That's all I needed. So I wasn't given any drugs. And they didn't talk about operations to me But there was a lot of speculation from various other board members and people that, that's what I might be needing. But that never entered my mind for a moment, personally. But people did speculate.
And how did they know after 4 days that you were okay to go? Did they do more tests and your kidneys were improved?
They must have done. I can't remember exactly.
Did you tell the doctor about Padma Sama?
I can't remember really. Yeah.
And that was your last time in Gukyaloka?
That was the last time, yeah. So I'm about to go again. So I'll be at Otraloka for 3 months, April, May and June, staying there with Manju Bhajra and Sagrasila, and entering into meditation retreat with them. They're close friends. So I'm very much looking forward to that. So the circle continues.
Great. Okay. Thank you so much, yeah. Prakasha. That's really, really good. Yeah, I really appreciate it.